This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. This is a question about, I guess, a recent article or book in an article that was published by Ayn Hirsi Ali, who proposes five reforms that Islam needs. And, the question I ask, are these good criteria for differentiating between moderate and extreme Muslims? Now, I don't like this whole idea of moderate versus extreme. I mean, they are jihadis who are threatening us, Islamic totalitarians, who are a military threat and need to deal with militarily and politically. And then there's Islam, which is a religion, and qua religion, to the extent that it is taken seriously, is philosophically an enemy. It is a problem that needs to be addressed on a philosophical, ideological level. So there are two groups that need to be dealt with. One is militarily and one ideologically. And the militarily one is Islamic totalitarianism. And you're not gonna get rid of that with moving them to become more moderate. Right? You have to shatter their worldview, and the only way to do that is through military force. What you have to do is slowly and systematically eviscerate it, eliminate it, but you do that by moving them to become less and less Muslim. And it's not to become more moderate, it's to become less of it. So to the extent that Ayn Hirsi and Ali's criteria move them away from their religion, that's good. And that's what happened during the Reformation, but really during the Enlightenment in the West. People became less religious. In other words, they took their religion less seriously, less by the book. They became more and more secular, and religion was something you did on Sundays. You went to church, you said a few prayers, and you left it alone. It wasn't enmeshed in every aspect of their lives as it was, as religion was, I think, before, certainly in the Middle Ages and even all the way up to the Enlightenment. And, if you think about Americans today, the Americans today are not, most Americans today, even though they claim to be religious, they're not really that religious. They live very secular lives. They consume very secular products all over the place. They're not following Jesus' word on a day-to-day basis. They go to church a lot and they give lip service to religion a lot. But are they living the Sermon on a Mount every day? No. And, they're living a pursue-your-happiness, consumer, self-interested life to a large extent, and they feel guilty about it, so they say a few prayers on the weekend. And that's what we want to bring to the Muslims. We want to reduce the impact of Islam. We want to reduce it from their lives. And if you look at the criteria, that's really what she's talking about, right? Want to get rid of a literal interpretation of the Quran, which happened in Christianity. We got rid of the literal interpretation of the New Testament and the Old Testament as we became less religious. The supremacy of life after death, that idea needs to be eviscerated. Well, once you give up on the idea that life after death is supreme, a big chunk of religion has gone away. A big chunk of why you live your life has gone away. You have to find reasons to live your life that are in this world, which is huge in terms of making you less religious. Sharia, no religious laws, which basically means separation of church and state. Great, less religious. Right and duty for individual Muslims to enforce religious laws. This has to do with Sharia and jihad and all that stuff. So what we need to endorse, to the extent that Ayn Hirsi Ali's five reforms move Muslims away from religion, they're great. And I think they do. So yeah, I'm all for it. Ultimately, what you need is for them to abandon their religion. But that's like, they have to do this before they abandon religion. And they have to gain a respect, so it's not just a negative, turn it into a positive. They have to gain a respect for reason and science, which is the opposite of faith. Okay, so here's a question about capitalism. How many people are simply misinformed about the benefits and virtues of capitalism as opposed to hatreds of the good for being the good? How can you tell the difference? Well, I don't think those are only two categories. I think there are a lot of people who are misinformed about capitalism and its virtues. up to a point. Because as I've said many times in my speeches, to some extent you have to be blind, deaf and dumb to be ignorant of the benefits and virtues of capitalism. But then I think that the people who at some level know that capitalism is beneficial, but find capitalism immoral, even though they won't say it in those terms, they emotionally, their altruism kicks in and they reject capitalism because of altruism. And then they're the haters. The haters of the good for being the good. And I would say that the smallest group is the haters. But it's the most influential group. The haters are the intellectuals. The haters are the history and economics professors. The haters are the Paul Krugmans of the world. The haters are the Bernie Sanders of the world, or Obama. So we're talking about the intellectuals, the influencers, the commanding heights, if you will, of the culture. They're the haters. I think the vast majority of people are motivated by altruism to ignore the reality that is so evident in front of them. So they, because they're altruistic, they live in a contradiction between the virtues of capitalism and their altruism, and, you know, in a contradiction between the facts of economics and politics and morality. Morality always wins. So even though they know that capitalism is good, their altruism sways them and they vote against capitalism. And then the third category, which is a substantial size, particularly outside the United States, and particularly in the third world, are people who are just ignorant about the virtues of capitalism, about its benefits, about the economic truth of how it works. All right, so this is a common comment I hear. But Europe and Canada have better health outcomes than America. Yeah, I mean, that's true if you're not sick. So if you have the snivels, you get treated by a doctor for free. So in the United States, you might not go to the doctor when you get the snivels because you might just lie in bed and just let it play itself out, which is probably the only treatment you need anyway. In Canada or in Europe, because it's free, why not go to the doctor? Why not make sure it's not something worse, although 99.9% of the cases it's not. But if you have cancer, or if you have heart disease, and you can look this up, the survival rates in the United States are far, far, far better than they are in Europe and Canada. If you have some critical need for an MRI or a CAT scan, that critical need will not be met in Europe and Canada because you'll be waiting in line to get the CAT scan while your disease gets worse. In the United States, you can get it within minutes from arriving in an emergency room or at your doctor's. He could send you to get an MRI within minutes. So if there's a life-threatening situation, or if you have a life-threatening disease, or if you just have a horrible condition that needs to be treated urgently and, you know, intensely, then you're much better off in the U.S. But again, if it's just routine stuff, if it's no big deal, and you don't mind waiting in lines, and you can wait for the MRI for 3 weeks because it's not going to kill you and the treatment is not urgent and stuff, then in that sense, you know, outcomes are better in Europe and Canada. But even then, I would argue, outcome for whom? Right? The doctors are treated really badly. Europe and Canada have doctor shortages. You're still waiting in lines. Ultimately, you know, there's no real measure of what the cost is for most of us for healthcare because of the massive redistribution of wealth in Canada. You have somebody pays for it. It's not clear that you're not paying a lot more for a lot inferior product than in Canada because of the whole social constellation that is built around healthcare in those countries. But quality goes down. There is no question. Lines go up. Doctors' rights are violated. Your rights as a patient are violated. Also, something else you don't realize is, or a lot of people don't think about, the fact that Europe and Canada do no innovation in healthcare because all the innovation in healthcare happened in places like the United States because we still have a semblance of freedom. So in a sense, they are free riding. They're benefiting from the fact that we still have freedom. So the extent that they have good treatments, it's because we developed them here in the United States because we still have freedom over here. How do you price that? The fact that they paid low prices on drugs is because we are forced to pay high prices on drugs in order to subsidize them. And that's exactly how it works, by the way, so that the drug companies can still do R&D. We subsidize all the R&D for the entire pharmaceutical industry, for the entire world, because the Europeans drive drug prices way, way low by force, through coercion. What would happen if we stopped doing that? What would happen to the European and Canadian system? So they free ride off of us enormously. But yeah, the healthcare I have is the best healthcare in the world. If you have health insurance in the United States, you get the best healthcare in the world. So there's a question about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Obama got fast-track approval to negotiate with many countries around the Pacific Rim. And this is generally a treaty that will expand trade. So generally, I'm for trade. I'm for free trade and for expansion of trade. And I think the best way to achieve that is by unilaterally lowering our tariffs to zero and then using diplomacy to try to encourage everybody else to do the same. But that is not going to happen. No president, Republican or Democrat, is going to do that. That would require a whole philosophical economic revolution in this country, which we're not quite ready for. Short of that, anytime we can negotiate with country X or with 12 countries all at once, that everybody lower their tariffs in some substantial way on goods, services, then I'm all for that. And of course, also capital flows. And ultimately, it would be great if we could reduce the barriers on labor flows. Then that's a good thing. And I think generally, even though the Trans-Pacific Partnership has a lot of places in which tariffs are not being lowered, in which particular countries are getting particular favors about certain things, it has some environmental regulations in it. It has some labor concessions to the labor unions in some countries. Overall, it is a general movement towards more freedom. That is, to less taxes, less coercion, less intervention in international trade. So it moves us incrementally towards free trade, and as such, is a good thing, even though it has many, many, many flaws, and you could do a lot better.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.